You're listening to Catholic Talk Radio in Chicago and the suburbs on Relevant Radio 950 AM.
Good morning. I'm Cardinal Francis George. Wow. For the next hour, the Archdiocese of Chicago will be hosting discussions on issues, people, and associations that touch our lives. Welcome to the Catholic Community of Faith.
Good morning, everybody. This is Bob Gilligan with the Catholic Conference of Illinois. And as we get situated here, we're going to talk about some pressing public policy issues that have been in the news lately and some other topics as well. As we get our headphones situated here and other things, we're off to a good start. Maybe it's that dreary Monday in January type of effect that it's having on us. This is Bob Gilligan of the Catholic Conference of Illinois, and once a month we are able to get on these airwaves, and we're very grateful for that, to talk about different public policy issues, both state and nationally, that affect the Catholic Church and just in general, the issues that affect all people in our state, in our nation. And today we should probably make a brief note that before we get started, we should just make a mention that it's the, I never know what word to use, I suppose it's the commemoration of the Roe v. Wade decision back in 1972, I think it was.
73,
I was close. I knew that when I was saying that was a little off. 73 that made killing of the unborn legal in our country. And today I know there's a lot of people from the Archdiocese and from all over the state in Washington to participate in the March for Life. And if anybody has done that, they'll know what a significant event that is. And for people who have not, I'd suggest someday that you do so. So they'll be in Washington today, and it'll always be interesting for those of us who follow these issues to review the media coverage of it to see if it makes the news at all. There are literally I don't know the number, tens of thousands, if not more people that attend that every year. And it's a shame that it doesn't get covered more widely by the press. But as we've known lately and been reinforced, that the mainstream media is not always indicative of what's going on in our nation and what's going on with people who are concerned with. Today, we're very lucky. We have three topics that we're going to talk about. We're going to talk a little bit about a breaking story that came out Friday regarding the Department of Health and Human Services rules and regulations. We're also going to talk really probably more in depth about another court decision that came out recently. It's called the Hosanna-Tabor decision. And we're going to talk about that for the first probably 20 minutes of our show. We're going to do a little bit also probably about 20-25 after the hour, talk a little bit about immigration and some recent policy changes that have gone on in that area. We're going to have Mark Fleming from the National Immigration Justice Center with us as well. And then to close the show, we're going to talk about an exciting development, a positive development, which is the final, the passage of something called the Earned Income Tax Credit. And Dave Marsall will be on the phone with us from Chicago. He is with an organization called the Center for Economic Progress. But first, we're very honored to have us with this morning, who has also fought the traffic to get here as well, just as I did. Jim Gioli, who is an attorney. He is with the firm of Burke, Warner, McKay, and Saratella. He has been very helpful to the Catholic Conference over the years in a number of issues, mostly pertaining to religious liberties. And it seems like that's the topic du jour of the last couple of years, and probably will in the future. Jim, welcome.
Good morning.
Good. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
I mentioned at the outset, there was a kind of a startling, I think, decision. I was in Washington in December, and the folks in Washington were saying that they were optimistic that the Obama administration would adopt some of our suggestions as it relates to a rule that the Department of Health and Human Services had promulgated, but they didn't take any suggestions. They left it as is. Jim, do you want to just talk briefly about what the rule was?
Sure. This is, pardon me, I think we're both battling a head cold today.
We are.
this is a feature of Obamacare that has been controversial in that, at least in the view of the United States Catholic Conference, would lead to a requirement that Catholic and other religious institutions, in providing insurance for their employees, would have to provide insurance that would cover contraception and arguably abortion services. And there's some debate about that, but that's part of the argument. And what is interesting about it, and maybe a little surprising, is that on the one hand, whatever one thinks about the politics of the country right now, you might imagine that a president in this situation would like to be able to say that he is tolerant, that he is understanding of a right of conscience, that he might support abortion rights on the one hand, but he wouldn't want to compel anyone to support them on the other hand, and that even in terms of providing insurance coverage for contraception, that he would let churches govern themselves according to their own doctrine. And one thought, and I think this is the reason for the optimism that you heard originally, that that was where the administration was going. Mm-hmm. If for no other reason,
like that.
It's awfully good politics,
right,
for the general electorate. But there are competing pressures on a Democratic president running for re-election, and there are important interest groups that wanted this rule to stay hard and fast. What is interesting, I suppose, is yes, he did leave the rule in place. This does set up a major constitutional confrontation. I understand that there are two cases pending now brought by the Beckett Fund who are very
mm-hmm.
good
right.
And really are able to litigate these kinds of issues very well. But on the other hand, if I read the news reports right, he's kicked the can down the road a year.
Right.
They've delayed the implementation of the rule until, of course, after the election, as if we're going to forget between now and November that this is pending. And I think it's I'll just make one more quick note here.
Sure.
I mean, what really is underneath all of this is a battle between the right of conscience of religious institutions against what is the current public policy agenda of a fairly left-wing group of constituency groups for whom religion just is not all that important. Perhaps it's fair to say this is more of the secularization of society that we've seen and less tolerance for religiously motivated behavior. So you saw references in the news, and if you've been watching in Illinois in the last few months, there was this litigation involving a number of the Catholic charities of dioceses who simply wanted to be able to place children for foster care and adoption in accordance with their beliefs and let anyone who didn't want to be subject to that
right.
go anywhere else they wanted to.
Right. We've talked about that a number of times, exactly.
And yeah. and it's kind of the same sentiment. It's an unwillingness to make even the slightest modicum of an accommodation for a religiously motivated position, even where, you know, doing so does no harm. You know, every other institution could place for adoption or foster care wherever they want, but they needed to nail Catholic charities to the wall and drive them out of the business. If this goes to the end and it really plays out, you know, they will be nailing Catholic institutions to the wall, and their alternative would be that they won't be able to provide benefits to their employees at all.
This is a big deal. This is a very high concern of the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops. I know the bishops were already very concerned about this pending rule, and this happened just came out Friday at about 11 o'clock, so I haven't had time to talk to many people about it, but I can just imagine that the wheels are turning back in Washington in terms of what the reaction is going to be and what the next step is going to be. The number, if you want to join our conversation, is 312-255-8408. We're talking with Jim Gioli, who is an attorney with Burke, Warner, McKay, and Saratella, about some of the recent developments that have gone on pretty much nationally as it relates to the Department of Health and Human Services rule. Yeah, I think, I don't know if you had a chance to see Archbishop or Cardinal-designate Dolan, he did a two-minute video. I thought he was very good, and he talked about that year delay in terms of the implementation, and I think his flippant comment was, well, you just gave us one more year before we have to violate our conscience. And it's really too bad if this is the direction that our country's going, because it appears we're headed to either lawsuit or we're headed to congressional action, and this will be a high profile either legislative or judicial battle, I think, probably fairly soon.
Right. I mean, the outcome of this dispute is you're going to have to wait for the election. I mean, by putting it off till after the election, if President Obama was trying to avoid the issue, he's actually made it an issue.
Exactly.
And now for Catholics who care about this, you know, we're not endorsing anybody here in this radio program, but the fact is,
it's going to be a big deal.
You
right.
know how the election comes out.
Right.
It's another thing that will fall with the outcome of the election.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people need to understand, just in a sentence, in essence, what this is doing, this is going to mandate that a Catholic institution, such as, you know, St. Joseph's Hospital, has to provide morally objectionable services in their health care plans to their employees. Where's the religious freedom there? This is Bob Gilligan. I'm hearing the music. We're going to take a quick break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Choosing an elementary school for your child is one of the biggest decisions you will ever make to shape your child's future. So why pick a Catholic school?
I want my kids to learn more than the three R's. They need a faith-based education so they make good decisions.
I want my son and daughter to go to college. At Catholic schools, attendance and graduation rates are nearly 100%. And when these kids graduate, they go to college.
My teacher is so cool. She knows who I am. She helps me when I have trouble figuring things out.
My son is in the number. The student-teacher ratio is 18 to 1, and Catholic school teachers are really dedicated.
I want my daughter to feel welcome, to be safe.
The test scores are well above the national average. Look out, college. Here they come.
Go to www.archchicago.org and click on Schools to learn more about the great benefits of a Catholic education. Invest in your child's future. Make your child a winner for life.
When a neighbor's cupboards are bare, we help. When our cupboards are bare, we need your help. The past few months have been the most difficult for families that come to Catholic Charities for food. Demand is up and donations are down. Help us restock our shelves so we can feed those in need this winter. Visit catholiccharities.net/food or call 312-655-7525 to find out how you can help.
If someone close to us begins to talk about their childhood sexual abuse, many of us don't know how to respond. The Archdiocese of Chicago's Office of Assistance Ministry is offering a one-day workshop for family and friends of victim survivors of childhood sexual abuse. A licensed clinical social worker will lead the program that will be offered on Saturday, February 4th. For more information, call Kathleen Legdis at 312-534-5268. That's Kathleen Legdis at 312-534-5268.
Welcome back, everybody. We're talking about, we're talking more about the Washington-related issues right now, but it affects all of us. It affects us here in Illinois and in every state in the country. We're talking a little bit about the Department of Health and Human Services regulations that were just, unfortunately, not refined by the Obama administration come Friday. But we're going to make a transition here to talk a little bit now about a recent case that's actually some good news. It's called the Hosanna Tabor versus EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission case, and it has to do with also some First Amendment issues in terms of jurisdiction in hiring and firing. A rather controversial case, but the U.S. Supreme Court just ruled recently in a 9-0 decision that religious liberties applied in this certain case. But I won't go into trying to explain this case because it's a little dicey. Jim, you want to sort of take it from there? Give us the basics in terms of why do we care about this case?
Sure.
I mean, as a religious institution, why do I care about something called Hosanna Tabor?
Well, let me start by saying what the case is about. There is a doctrine that had been floating around in the appellate courts, the federal appellate courts of the United States, called the ministerial exception.
Right.
And what the ministerial exception said was that, without getting into definitions of words right now, that a minister could not challenge the employment decision of his or her church or religious organization in a civil court, and in particular, the term of art ministerial exception applied to the discrimination laws. So the point of all of this was a religious organization has an absolute right under the First Amendment to decide who will be its minister. Therefore, if a minister is terminated or doesn't like the terms and conditions of employment or has any other beef in the employment as a minister, that person cannot bring a claim under the employment discrimination laws to challenge the employer's decision because to do so would interfere with this basic fundamental constitutional right to decide who will be the minister for this church, who will be our spokesperson, who will be our representative, because that has been viewed by the courts as the lifeblood of a religious denomination or of a religious organization. Different circuit courts of appeal in the United States have applied the ministerial exception differently. Some have had a very strict test and limited its application to very narrow circumstances. Others have looked at it more broadly and said that the First Amendment, in as much as it protects this right of churches, has to also protect the church's right to define what is a minister, because to even broach that is to trample on their religious liberty rights. This came to a head in a case, I believe, out of
Michigan.
In the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeal, involving the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And in the Lutheran Church, at least in some of their schools, teachers can be called as ministers.
Called as in parentheses. They're called in terms of vocation or
exactly.
They go through
training. They get certification. They're expected to not only teach the academic subjects but also to lead classes in prayer. They even lead certain religious ceremonies at the school. It's a pretty obviously religious function. But in addition to all of that, the church itself views called teachers as ministers. They're called ministers. Mm-hmm. They're actually labeled as ministers. A case was litigated where a minister / teacher in this role had a disability. She had narcolepsy. She left the job for a leave of absence. When she wanted to return, the job had been filled. She insisted she was able to do the work. The school did not feel she could do the work, and it ultimately led to her termination. And in addition, the congregation, which issued the quote-unquote call, rescinded the call. Mm. They decided she was not to be a called teacher in their school anymore. At the trial court level, the court applied the minister. And let me just finish the thought. So she filed a lawsuit under the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is one of the employment discrimination laws. It's in that family to which the ministerial exception would apply. The suit was filed at the trial court level. The trial court judge agreed that the ministerial exception applied and dismissed the lawsuit. It was appealed to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Sixth Circuit did this intense scrutinization of the reasoning about whether or not this person was or was not a minister. And to boil it all down, they said that although she was labeled as a minister by the church and considered that, at least by church officials and those who were on the defendant side, the practical functional aspects of what the teacher did were such that they did not believe she was a minister, because although she did do religious functions, she did many, many things that were not religious functions. And in addition, there were teachers who were quote-unquote lay teachers who were not called, who were not ministered, mm-hmm. that appeared to be doing some of the same work as this called teacher. And for those reasons, the circuit court said this just isn't enough to exempt you from the employment discrimination laws. The case was appealed to the United States Supreme Court and was handled by a very well-known and respected law professor / religious liberty expert, Douglas Laycock, who did a fabulous job. And what the basic argument was that, number one, it's for churches to decide who is and isn't a minister, not for secular judges. If we consider the person to be a minister, they're a minister. Number two, you can't do this in some kind of mechanical adding and subtracting of hours. If you spend this many hours doing math and that many hours leading prayer, what it really is about is the person being held out as the true spokesperson and representative for the church.
Why do we? I think that the interesting part about this case is where does the state's interest in defining to the degree that a person is doing religious instruction, and where does the religious entity's authority come to define what is not ministerial? And I think that's the problem. I mean, because as I'm listening to you, and I'd urge the listeners to listening to this conversation to also examine is, the particular individual you're talking about in this case was called. So she had some form of religious instruction in her job function. But quite frankly, many of our employees, a math teacher at a Catholic school is not necessarily called in terms of her job and theological instruction. Yet, I think we would argue that that individual being employed by the Catholic Church is in fact subject to this ministerial protection. So it's a little, it's a win. In terms of probably for the church and religious institutions. But it also, I think, led some things out there that may be litigated in the future.
Yes, well, let me make two points. First of all, the court said very clearly, look, this case is a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
We understand that there are some complicated issues that are going to come up in future cases where somebody will really have to decide whether the person is or is not a minister. And the court cautioned lower courts not to intrude into religious or doctrinal questions in making that determination.
Mm.
But the court acknowledged that this particular case didn't resolve all those issues. They said whatever that test is going to ultimately be, this case is going to pass it. This is a no-brainer. While these factors that the appellate court considered might have been too intrusive, they undervalued the church's own view of the teacher's role, the court said we're not counting any one of these facts as dispositive. Even the fact that most of the time spent was on secular activities, we're not saying you're not allowed to consider that, but it should never have overcome the underlying truth that this was a called minister. But so there will be future cases where the test will be applied. Not every diocese in the United States takes the position that a teacher in a Catholic school is subject to the ministerial exception.
Mm.
Some of them view the teachers as not ministers, but might view the principals as ministers, because principals in most dioceses have to be practicing Catholics in communion with the church, and the role of the principal is described a little bit differently in conveying the Catholic faith than the role of the math teacher. I'm not making a pronouncement there.
Sure.
I just know that this varies throughout the Catholic world. One of the leading cases in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is based in Chicago, involves the Archdiocese of Chicago and includes an Hispanic outreach official who worked directly at the pastoral center, and there was a fight over whether that was a minister, because she was not called, she was not ordained, she didn't have a religious title, but her office in the pastoral center had the job of conveying the faith to an entire community in the Chicago area, and to being have the responsibility of being the spokesperson for the archdiocese in a religious way. That was sufficient for the Court of Appeals to qualify the person as a minister and apply the ministerial exception.
And as states and jurisdictions such as Illinois enact laws such as civil unions and same-sex marriage in other states, we're going to see this potential clash probably come to fruition sooner than later.
Right, and in a much more difficult landscape.
Exactly. This is Bob Gilligan. We're talking with Jim Gioli. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Each night, thousands of families face homelessness in Chicago. Those families aren't just statistics. They're your neighbors, your friends. They could even be part of your own family.
I had lost my job, so I wasn't working, and I had run out of all my savings, so I ended up losing my apartment. And I went to stay with my sister, but she's got this small little itty-bitty condo, so we were all sleeping on the floor. So I started calling around for the housings and everything, and they told me to call Catholic Charities, and it just happened when I got through. Joanne answered the phone, and she goes, you know, you got me just at the right time. We're actually doing interviews right now. You want to come in? And gave me the whole rundown of everything and how the program works and everything. She goes, is this something you can do? And I looked at her and says, you're offering me a roof over my head, something more than I've got right now, and I'm willing to do anything to keep that roof over my head.
Catholic Charities of Chicago is there to provide a helping hand to the homeless. Find out how to help us help the most needy. Visit CatholicCharities.net.
If you haven't read the Catholic New World lately, you're in for quite a surprise. It's bigger, bolder, and better than ever before.
The Catholic New World is a rich and diverse resource for Catholics throughout the Archdiocese of Chicago. It carries stories of faith, hope, and inspiration. Our most read column is by Cardinal Francis George, our shepherd, teacher, and leader.
Our columnists provide support in spirituality and evangelization. And you'll want to browse the Around the Archdiocese page, your gateway to Catholic activities.
No matter how busy you are, stay connected to your church by visiting CatholicNewWorld.com and sign up to follow us on Twitter.
Go to CatholicNewWorld.com to view our photo gallery, catch up on the latest news, and to subscribe. Or call 312-534-7777.
Subscribe now, and a portion of your fee will go to the Archdiocesan school of your choice. It's your faith resource. Subscribe now to the Catholic New World.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Bob Gilligan of the Catholic Conference talking about, this seems to be Federal Day. It just kind of dawned on me that it seems like we're talking about federal regulations more than anything today. We were just talking with Jim Gioli from Burke, Warner, McKay, and Saratella about pretty much two regulations, the mandate on from the Department of Health and Human Services that just came down, as well as the Supreme Court case regarding the Hosanna-Tabor decision in terms of the ministerial exception. So, Jim, it looks like we're going to probably see other cases, I think, down the road, and at least with the regard to the ministerial exception, defining what it is and is not the ministerial exception. And so we'll see what happens in the future, I suppose, with these cases. But at least for the time being, it seems like it was a win.
It was a big win. And just as a concluding thought, number one, the U.S. Supreme Court categorically reaffirmed and made clear that the ministerial exception is a constitutional doctrine. It trumps all statutes. It's not just an exception in a statute. And number two, the court made clear that that the secular courts cannot be in the business of making doctrinal decisions of what is a minister. Filling in all the blanks will be for the future.
Absolutely. And who knows? Maybe we'll have you back way too soon to talk about the other issue.
It's always a pleasure.
If that always goes to the court. Jim, thanks so much for joining us. And with that, we'll say goodbye to Jim and thank him for being on the air. And so what we'll do now is let's go to our next topic, which is also a little bit regarding regulations coming down from Washington. I suppose we could put this in the good news category as opposed to the bad news category. We're grateful for having Mark Fleming join us this morning. And Mark is with the National Immigration Justice Center. Mark, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it.
So about, what was it, a month or two ago? I don't know. Time happens so fast now. Was it
about a month ago?
It was about a month ago? Okay. The Obama administration, in terms of the good news side of the ledger, came out with an interesting regulation. And we think it may help families stay in the U.S. a little longer if they are in the process of. Why don't you fill us in on what the Obama administration is trying to do?
What it does is it basically fixes one of the more dysfunctional parts of our immigration system. So I bet a lot of Americans and your listeners probably don't realize that when a U.S. citizen marries an immigrant who may not be in a legal status, that does not cure their problem of having been living in the country in an illegal status. And so what happens in those cases is the individual has to, the wife, the husband, and any minor children have to travel back to their home country.
The non-U.S. citizen has to go back to their country
from where they came from in order to regularize their papers, get them in order, and head towards permanent residency and a green card. Now, a component of that is as soon as they leave the country, after having lived in the U.S. in an illegal status, they trigger what's called a bar to reentering the U.S. And so typically, it's either a 3-year if they had lived in the U.S. for 6 months illegally, and if they lived over a year, a 10-year bar. And so while they've married a U.S. citizen, they're facing potentially 10 years of separation from that spouse.
That's sane.
And so what the system had set up was there was a waiver system. And so the individual, the spouse, and any children would have to wait through that process of seeking that waiver, which often dragged on for months, often over a year, where there would be separation in their home country. What this this change would do. And I should caution that it's just a proposed change.
It's proposed, right? Okay. Yeah.
And so they're going to propose rules on it this spring. And the thought is that by fall that it will be implemented.
Okay.
And really all it does is it changes the procedures. Basically, the U.S. citizen can petition for their spouse and any minor children in the U.S., which is the same. The difference being is that they can request the waiver while the individual is here, have the waiver approved, and then the individual, the spouse, would only have to travel for just a short interview. So the separation would be much shorter for the family.
I was talking to somebody the other day who was telling me about actually an employee of one of the dioceses, and she is a U.S. citizen and married a person who was, I believe he was undocumented. They were married. They were very fortunate to conceive a child right after they were married. I don't recall the exact situation, but he had to go back to, I think it was Mexico, before the child was born, and was not present at the child's birth, waiting in Mexico for the papers to be finalized. And I don't know how old the child was by the time he got here, but it was after, I know it was after the child's birth. That doesn't sound, I mean, I understand the person is here legally. I get that. But there's got to be a way that we can, and I know this happens, that people meet in whatever situation, they fall in love, they get married. So now they are doing everything according to, at least now, according to the law. They've married and now they're having a child and they're hopefully going to raise that child to be a contributing member of society. Sir. But it seems a little illogical that you would have to go back to your country of origin while the person you've married and now going to have a child with is, that just doesn't sound like it makes any sense at all.
And allowing them to seek the waiver here, and I should be clear, there are other situations where you would need to seek other waivers. So, for example, if you had any criminal record,
of course,
going to request that you're going to need a different waiver, and that would not fall under this change in rules.
Nor should it. Yeah. Okay.
So this is for folks that outside of course the entering the country illegally at some point or overstaying a visa, which is more often the case, that those folks would have an opportunity if they married a U.S. citizen to get most of the paperwork done here, and then only have to travel abroad for back to their home country for the interview.
We're talking with Mark Fleming of the National Immigration Justice Center. We're talking about the proposed rule from the Obama administration that would allow families to stay intact while some immigration issues are pending. We're going to talk to him about this issue, and I'm just wondering when we come back, Mark, I have a really simple question. It's like, why do all these applications take so long? It just seems like we're wasting a lot of time processing applications, and it shouldn't take years. But anyway, I'm sure there's a reason somewhere. So when we come back, we'll talk about that and also what's going on here locally in terms of Cook County and their detention situation. This is Bob Gilligan. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Most interment arrangements at the 43 Archdiocese of Chicago cemeteries are made through a pre-need plan. Your thoughtful planning today is economically prudent and contributes to peace of mind for you and your loved ones. Catholic Cemeteries counselors are available at your convenience. For more information, call 708-449-6100. Catholic Cemeteries, serving the Catholic community since 1837.
You're listening to Catholic Talk Radio in Chicago and the suburbs on Relevant Radio 950 AM.
Every Monday through Friday from 9 to 10 a.m., the Archdiocese of Chicago presents programming about the people, the issues, and the faith that affect all our lives. Thanks for staying with us here on Relevant Radio 950 AM. Now again, the Catholic Community of Faith.
This is Bob Gilligan with the Catholic Conference of Illinois. We're talking with Mark Fleming from the National Immigration Justice Center about the proposed Obama regulations. Mark, we're talking about the break. Before the break, I was just asking, I was like, why does it seem like the time to process these applications are so long? I mean, you hear these stories of, you know, even people coming in from other countries that want to do it legally. I think one of the things on a personal note that frustrates me about the immigration question is that I understand, I'm very sympathetic to the argument that, you know, some people here are legally and that sort of thing. And how do we fix that is the question. And I think one of the frustrations that many of us look at this from a logical standpoint is that, well, you know, if we need X number of workers, why don't we let X number of workers in? I know this is a slightly different topic, but it just seems like everything takes so long for applications to be processed. And is it a lack of manpower? Is it a lack of desire? Is it a lack of, is the system just so complicated that it would take bureaucrats so long to determine these issues? Or
I think ultimately it's a combination of those factors.
Yeah, probably.
It's one of those situations where the growth in the number of applications has gone up exponentially, and the resources have not matched that. That said, I don't think the bureaucracy has efficiently placed its resources where its focus should be. I mean, there's some, as you allude to, there's a lot of these just open and closed cases that either they fight or they dig into too deeply. There needs to be a more efficient use of resources, because I agree. There are definitely enforcement issues that need to be dealt with in immigration. And I think, unfortunately, those resources often go towards what would be more low-hanging fruit rather than the more difficult cases that probably need enforcement, where you're involving criminal issues and things of that sort.
Yeah, it just amazes me in this highly computerized era that we can process so much information, and yet in this area, it just doesn't seem to happen. And there's reasons why, and it's probably for a number of those things. We're having problems here, all of us, today with coughs and colds, so we apologize. I think Jim wasn't feeling too good. I'm not feeling too great. And Mark's looking good, but I'm not sure if you're feeling too good either. It seems like that seems to be going around. Mark, let's talk a little bit also about this has been a controversy recently that I recall my first exposure to it, quite frankly, was in a column that John Cass wrote about the detention policy in Cook County. It seems like there's a little bit of a war or a battle going on between ICE, John Morton, and the Cook County Board President, Tony Preckwinkle, with regard to the detention of those people who are violated the law, it looks like, right?
Yeah, so if I could give kind of a
Please,
background
yeah, because this
on
is
it,
complicated.
Because I think it's one of those things where people are coming into the discussion late in
yeah,
the
and
process.
I'm one of them.
And so the issue is about these things called immigration detainers. And what it is it's a document that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, sends to Cook County and any other local county that says, we're interested in possibly removing this individual. We think this person may be removable. They haven't done a full investigation yet, but please hold this person. And as soon as you're about to release them, hold them for an additional 48 hours so that we can assume custody of the individual. Now, what happens when one of those detainers is honored is the 48 hours goes, the county is paying that expense, and then ICE comes, picks the person up, and either A, starts removal proceedings, takes them into ICE custody, starts removal proceedings, or releases the individual because they determine that the person is not, in fact, removable, that they may be a U.S. citizen and they didn't realize it, or it may be that they haven't been convicted of a crime that would make them removable as a legal permanent resident. So a whole host of reasons why they may not ultimately put them in removal proceedings. So fast forward, over the summer, Sheriff Dart, who is Cook County Sheriff. Did a number of interviews where he was saying that the jails were being filled up with these individuals who were often on very low minor charges, who had immigration detainers on them that were taking considerable space and county resources. That were really conflicting with the police's ability to fight crime. Moreover, by honoring detainers and becoming a form of immigration enforcement. It was creating fear within the immigrant communities to be witnesses to crimes, to come forward, or if they're victims of crime. And so he was looking for some discretion in this process.
And this is part of the problem, too, which is whose responsibility and whose jurisdiction is this in terms of is it the county's responsibility? Is it the federal government's responsibility? Is it the city's responsibility? And that's what we see a little bit in Arizona and some states taking action. So it's sort of like it seems like people are stepping up left and right to enforce various aspects of immigration law, which probably shouldn't be the case because it's more of a federal function than anything.
And so just to fast forward to the controversy is that the ordinance basically asks that if we're going to honor these detainers, that the federal government reimburse them for them. And the federal government hasn't, and so they stopped honoring them. Tragic case happens where a gentleman, William McCann, who has been the focus, he, over the summer, there was a undocumented immigrant who had a prior DUI, and it's unclear why he wasn't deported after the prior DUI. Needless to say, was drunk and killed this gentleman, William McCann, ran him over. Horrific case, really sad case. And so the undocumented immigrant was in Cook County custody, had a very low bond, was able to pay the bond, and because of the detainer ordinance, was released and now has subsequently absconded.
Okay.
What folks need to understand about the detainer ordinance is that it really can't be a backstop for the criminal justice system. The reality is that had the detainer been triggered and honored, this gentleman, Sal Chavez, who is the alleged perpetrator, would have ended up in immigration custody and very likely would have been deported well before he would have ever seen justice in Cook County. And so the controversy really is with the bond processing system and how low the bonds have been, and far less to do with immigration detainers. But nevertheless, the focus has been on this in part of because of the gentleman's undocumented status, when really it's more the fact that he really should have been held in criminal custody for trial.
Is this a problem in other areas of the country, or is it just Cook County?
With respect to the bonds?
Yeah.
President Preckwinkle is doing a study now. One of the reforms that they're seeking is to really look at this bond system. I suspect, and I'm no criminal justice expert, but I suspect that you see in a lot of urban centers that there's tons of pressure on the resources, and so you do see this bond sort of issue probably pop up in a lot of urban centers.
We have to do something in this country to fix the situation, and I think we're just all increasingly concerned, as it seems to be the politics of this country become more polarized, and the lack of willingness to break the pressure here is just seems to not be there anymore. And I'm not sure where this issue is going. It's been my opinion for quite some time that both sides have a point here. Yes, enforcement needs to be stronger, and yes, we need to deal with the situation we all know of, the person who's been here contributing in society, etc. How we negotiate that and how we deal through that situation, it takes parties sitting down and working out some sort of compromise that each side gets something, and it just doesn't seem to be happening, and I don't know where that's going to come from, especially in a presidential election year. We're with Mark Fleming. Mark, thanks so much for joining us. Let's do this. Let's take a quick break here. We'll come right back, and we can wrap up with Mark, and then we're going to go to our third topic, which is regarding the Earned Income Tax Credit. This is Bob Gilligan. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Choosing an elementary school for your child is one of the biggest decisions you will ever make to shape your child's future. So why pick a Catholic school?
I want my kids to learn more than the 3 R's. They need a faith-based education so they make good decisions.
I want my son and daughter to go to college. At Catholic schools, attendance and graduation rates are nearly 100%. And when these kids graduate, they go to college.
My teacher is so cool. She knows who I am. She helps me when I have trouble figuring things out.
My son is in the number. The student-teacher ratio is 18 to 1, and Catholic school teachers are really dedicated.
I want my daughter to feel welcome, to be safe.
The test scores are well above the national average. Look out, college. Here they come.
Go to www.archchicago.org and click on Schools to learn more about the great benefits of a Catholic education. Invest in your child's future. Make your child a winner for life.
Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Mark Fleming of the National Immigration Justice Center. And just to wrap up, in terms of, Mark, where the ordinance is going and what does the future hold on this?
So it came back to the commission, obviously, because of this tragic story. And, currently the commissioners are considering a number of possible amendments and are looking into more seriously looking into this bond issue and recognizing that, this is probably where any sort of justice in this and in assurance of public safety would be most effectively sought.
We were just talking at the break about Mark was had heard the brother or one of the family members of the person who was unfortunately killed, and it was quite an emotional situation. And our prayers go out to the family who has been affected by this, and clearly this issue needs to be addressed, like Mark was saying. I mean, as if the bonding issue, whatever, but we need to make sure that convicted criminals are not let loose. But on the other hand, we don't want to. The other part of this is that you're getting people who are innocent swept up in a system that they don't belong into. So how we balance those two things is going to take a little bit of prudence, and we hope that works out well. Mark, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for coming in. We were saying also that these topics are very complicated, so I'm glad Mark was here to help explain this, because I can't do it, because if I explained it, I'd confuse more people than I'd be able to. Mark, thanks so much for coming in, and I think we're going to switch to our third topic. I think on the phone we have with us Dave Marcel from the Center for Economic Progress. Are you with us, Dave?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave. It's so good to hear your voice.
Same here.
Hey, congratulations, I suppose. Let's talk a little bit about, we want to make some of the listeners aware of some good news, which is regarding the Earned Income Tax Credit. Why don't you explain what happened recently with Governor Quinn's recent signing of that bill?
Well, despite the state being in not very good fiscal shape and the unrelenting bad news out of Springfield, we did have a major victory late last year when the legislature, both houses of the legislature, passed an expansion in the state earned income tax credit, and then Governor Quinn, about 10 days ago, we joined with him to sign it. The earned income tax credit, just to take a step back, is there's a state version and there's a federal version.
Right.
It is the most effective anti-poverty program in the kind of government's arsenal, so to say. Here in Illinois, we've had a very small credit, just 5% of the federal, and I can in a few minutes probably explain more details of it. But this victory basically means that starting when people file their returns for this year in 2012, and then again in 2013, 2014, they will see a doubling of their refund if they qualify for the earned income tax credit. So this is very good news for lower income working families. The EITC, as it's called, is mainly targeted at families with one or two children. And again, given all the bad news around both pocketbook issues and where the government is at fiscally, this was a big step in the right direction for the working families here in Illinois.
I know Governor Quinn, it's I don't know how to say this, but it's almost personal with him. I know he's a huge proponent of this this policy idea, and we have talked to him about this, and he was very happy that this was finally come to fruition, because I know it's been in the works for years after Illinois passed it. What was that, 10 years ago? And Dave, I guess, the main thing I think what we want to try to convey to listeners as best I can articulate is that it's such a good program because, in a nutshell, it just allows low-income working people to retain more of their money as opposed to sending it to Springfield, correct?
Correct. I mean, the beauty of the EITC is that there is virtually no, how shall we put it, infrastructure needed to deliver it. This is about working families who pay taxes, and because Illinois unfortunately has a rather regressive tax code where now we're taxed at 5% of income, and even very low-income families pay that tax, the EITC, in effect, acts as an offset. So all people have to do is to file a state return, claim their earned income tax credit if they're eligible for it. And to give you a sense of it, I'll give you a typical type of scenario here, which might be fairly useful. Is that in the current situation, a single parent family with one child, minimum wage worker, makes $12,800 a year. Their EITC is only worth $153.
Okay.
That will end up basically offsetting their state tax liability. Starting next year when they file, that EITC will increase to $225, and by 2014, when they file for 2013, it'll increase to $309. So it's a substantial increase, and in essence, what it means is that we're holding low-income families harmless under the tax code. They're paying a lot at the pump for gas. They're paying utility taxes. They're paying all sorts of other taxes, sales taxes, you name it. But when it comes to the income tax, we're saying you're working hard, you're playing by the rules, we want to support you. And in that respect, I think Governor Quinn, the state legislature, leaders such as Barbara Flynn Curry and others, Toy Hutchinson, who helped make this happen, this was not only good news, but I think a great work of legislative maneuvering given all the challenges in the legislature nowadays.
Yeah, if you're making $12,000, whatever the number you said, $12,800, and your EITC goes from $153 up to $300 in a couple of years, that's a lot of money, and that I'm sure they could use that money.
Absolutely.
You're at $12,000. Dave, don't go away. We'll be right back. We're going to talk a little bit more about the earned income tax credit, and we're going to talk off about how to make people aware of it. When we come back, we're talking with Dave Marshall of the Center for Economic Progress. This is Bob Gilligan. Don't go away.
You're invited to watch The Church, the Cardinal, and You this weekend on cable television. Here's host Graziano Marcheschi.
During the next half hour, we'll talk to Cardinal George about his ad limina visit to Rome and about turning 75. We'll show you highlights of the recent Posada on the streets surrounding Holy Name Cathedral. And our stewardship and development director will talk about all the good that comes from money collected during the annual Catholic Appeal.
For several interesting stories about the Archdiocese, please watch The Church, the Cardinal, and You this weekend on cable television. Go to www.archchicago.org and click on Radio TV for the time and cable channel in your area. That's www.archchicago.org. The Church, the Cardinal, and You, compelling television about your Archdiocese.
The Catholic New World has been your faith resource for well over a century. Archbishop Patrick Feehan recognized the need for a strong Catholic voice in 1892 and launched Chicago's first Catholic newspaper. Bishop Feehan named our Catholic newspaper using a theme from the Columbian Exposition, the New World that gave people hope for a brighter future. Today, the Catholic New World is better than ever. It's a rich and diverse resource for Chicagoland Catholics with stories of faith, hope, and inspiration. Cardinal Francis George and our team of columnists offer compelling insights on spirituality, catechesis, and evangelization. Visit our website at CatholicNewWorld.com. View our photo gallery, catch up on the latest news, and while you're there, subscribe to the Catholic New World or call 312-534-7777. Our look has changed, but we are still your faith resource. Subscribe now to the Catholic New World.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Bob Gilligan talking with Dave Marshall of the Center for Economic Progress. We're talking about the Earned Income Tax Credit and the effective date of the EITC's increase that was just passed by the General Assembly and signed by Governor Quinn just like a week or two ago. Dave, I think one of the things we want to talk about in the next, we have about 6-7 minutes to go, is so how do low-income wage earners, how do they find out about the EITC? I know your organization is very involved with kind of pumping that information out, but what can people do to make make sure that people are taking advantage of that of this opportunity.
Right, and I think what's important to say is that the state EITC is a small credit, but when you're filing your tax returns, you're always going to file a federal return, and the federal EITC is much larger than the state. And so as part of our work at the Center for Economic Progress in providing a wide range of free tax and financial services all across the state, we want to make sure that people are, filing the federal tax return, the state tax return, and we can help them do it. I mean, the bottom line here is that, unfortunately, the tax code is ridiculously complex.
Yeah,
a lot of people pay a lot of money to get their tax returns done, and along the way, money is taken out of their pocket that they've earned. They oftentimes get some of these high-priced loan products because they can't afford up front to pay the $200, $250 for the tax return. So we're there for them. I mean, we have 1,200 volunteers providing who are trained, who are certified, who prepare tax returns. We're throughout the Chicago metropolitan area. We are downstate in Springfield. We are in other locations as well. What I encourage people to do is visit our website, which is economicprogress.org, or we have a hotline, which is 888-827-8511. Again, 888-827-8511, and they can find out precisely where our services are. Just to give folks a sense, I mean, in Chicago itself, we have 7 sites. We're out in the suburbs in Waukegan and Elgin and Aurora and Joliet and Harvey. So really, at least within the metropolitan area, no one should have to drive more than 20, 30 minutes to, or take a bus or take a train to get to one of our locations.
It's a wonderful service, and I highly suggest anybody who needs the assistance or knows somebody who needs the assistance to take advantage of what Dave has just said with the Center for Economic Progress, because they really do provide a very valuable service. And on a personal level, I know, just doing my own taxes, sometimes you have to be very careful about who you're asking, and sometimes you may be better to go to the Center for Economic Progress than if you're financially eligible than some of the larger known tax preparers. Sometimes they're not as knowledgeable, perhaps, on some of these issues, but they're really looking out for your best interest at the Center for Economic Progress. And so I encourage anybody out there who needs that type of assistance to please contact that organization, because as Dave just said, it's not only now in Chicago, but you're pretty much throughout the entire state. So if you have friends or relatives that are low income or in need of that assistance, encourage them to make that. And you said it's a toll-free number as well.
That's right. So toll-free number for people to call. And I think the other important thing to mention, I mean, you talked briefly, Bob, about, getting the right kind of advice. Unfortunately, there are a lot of upside-down incentives out there for people to, for the commercial sector to provide a not very high-quality service at times, charge people a lot of money. Not only is this free, but we bring in more than 20 banks and credit unions to our tax site so that people get banked, that if they come in and they don't have a bank account, they can't take advantage of direct deposit. We'll work with them to ensure that their tax refund, whether it's federal or state, or preferably both, gets direct deposited into an account. And we've been able to move the needle a lot. We started 6 years ago, only 1 in 4 people had a bank account. Now 2 in 3 do.
Really?
And in
Great.
This age of virtually all government benefits, almost all commercial transactions taking place through online, we want to make sure that people have direct deposit, whether it's a checking account, a savings account with a bank or a credit union, or it's a prepaid card, so you can at least load your money onto a card that you can use with vendors, you can use for your paycheck. This is all part of our mission to move people from financial uncertainty towards financial security.
And trust is so much of a big part of that. We're dealing with money and private information, and so your organization can be trusted to not only to act in the best interest of the people that you're trying to serve, low-income people. And as you said, Dave, I think that's a very good point. Look, everything is being automated and computerized, and as we go forward, that is only going to accelerate. So there's no turning back, you need to feel like you have a bit of trust with the entity that you're dealing with, and it's nice to hear that you have those relationships with the banks and credit unions. We got about a minute or two left, Dave. Let's go over the information again, because I know people may not have caught it the first time, and it's important to say this more than once. So tell everybody how they can get a hold of the Center for Economic Progress if they they need assistance, not only with taxes, but with the other types of services you provide.
Right. I mean, it's to get your tax return prepared, federal and state. We'll also do for families with kids who are high school age who are planning to go to college, we'll do the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, to qualify for Pell and MAP grants and other need-based aid. What folks need to do is just call our main phone number, 888-827-8511, or visit our website at economicprogress.org. And at the website, if you just punch in your zip code, it'll tell you where the nearest location is. We do serve families making up to $50,000 a year, individuals up to $25,000 a year, and I hate to say it, but in this economy, that's about half of everyone living in the state of Illinois.
That's
so it's a pretty broad group of people who qualify for services. We do encourage people to come early when they want to get their taxes done, because it's first come, first serve. But we'd love to see folks.
Dave, thanks so much for this important information. We'll put up something on our website as well so people can get a hold of that information. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about the Earned Income Tax Credit. And also, we'd like to thank Mark Fleming, who's here talking about some very important immigration issues, as well as Jim Gioli, who talked about the DHHS regulations, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the very important Hosanna-Tabor Supreme Court decision. This is Bob Gilligan. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next month with some more important and exciting topics for discussion. Have a nice week, and everybody, have a nice day.